Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my psychic and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy and Lucas Moura enthusiast, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
I just love dribbling into dead ends and being completely unaware of everyone around me.
I've always said that about you, mate. How's it going, Nath?
Yeah, you know, more of the same walls. I've not, you know, been going down the pub or meeting with up to six people or whatever other nonsense. I am continuing to shelter my vulnerable parents. So it's more of the same for me, and it looks like it will be for a little while longer. But, you know, I'm coping.
Good, good, good. Bardi, how you doing?
Not too bad, Windy. Happy that we won a game, and I'm over the dullness of it and basking in 3 points.
I kind of need to apologise to both of you for our last podcast, because I was so downbeat and it really came across that way, and it set the mood for the whole pod, and I'm sorry for inflicting my misery on you both. I must admit, no. I felt better after.
I think that's what it feels like to lose under Jose Mourinho. I don't think that you should apologise for that. I think that, you know, you captured something very authentic that a lot of fans and I would imagine also listeners were feeling about that game. So I don't think you need to apologise for that at all.
Okay, you're very generous.
It's always the risk when you record straight after a match, and it is just, you don't have any time to reflect. But I'm not sure if time would have made you any happier. I spent the whole weekend avoiding all kind of football. Yesterday's match was the first game I'd watched since the Sheffield United match, so I'm not even sure time would have fixed it there.
That's not like you either, Bardi.
No, I like watching all the football, but I couldn't bring myself to do it.
So let's get stuck into the Everton game. It was a win. It was a 1-0 win. I don't think it really felt like a win. Okay, where to start? Team selection, I guess, is a good place to start, because let's take it chronologically. I guess there was some surprise that there were changes, but we expected a reaction after what happened against Sheffield United. Alderweireld came back into the back line for Davinson Sanchez, and Harry Winks came into midfield at the expense of Delhi.
Yep, Delhi,
yeah. So we were playing Winks, Sissoko and Lo Celso in a 4-3-3 midfield. Did you expect more changes, Bardi? Did you expect these changes? Were you expecting Dyer to be out of the team? Was it a surprise that Sanchez was the one who missed out?
I thought there would have been more changes. I thought maybe Mourinho would have kind of made a point, but then that's not taken into consideration who Mourinho is and the fact that he would only ever make small changes. When I saw the team, I was reasonably happy with it. Alderweireld was back, and whether it was Sanchez or Dyer alongside him, it was just a positive that he was back, because he is a calming influence. And I was happy to see Winks in there. We missed a kind of a link man against Sheffield United, so it was good to see him back, and I was overall generally happy with him.
Cool. And Nathan, when you saw the 11, were you thinking this is 4-3-3?
No, I was definitely thinking it was going to be a 4-3-1. I think it came in the order that would suggest that Lo Celso would be deeper, but as I am meaning to sort of spell out at great length, the order of the names on the team sheet doesn't really mean much at all. But lo and behold, it was a 4-3-3. Or at least it was for...
the first half.
Not even the entirety of the first half, the first half an hour or up until the goal, roughly, I think. And then a quick switch back to the 4-2-3-1 with Lo Celso moving forward into the number 10 role. I think I tweeted about this at half time, but I think that there was a tactical plan to build our play really deeply with our advanced midfield line pushed fairly high up so as to break up Everton's pressing and give our deeper players more time on the ball. I think that helped with that, but also really slowed us down, meant that we moved the ball incredibly slowly, and I think that we all really felt that. And then once we're a goal ahead, we moved to the 4-3-3-1. So we had a disagreement on this over Twitter. I thought it was a move about our defensive shape and about getting Lo Celso's pressing higher up the pitch and closing them down earlier. You thought it was more of an attacking thing?
Yes, I did. The way I saw it, I could be completely wrong on this. So in the first half or first half now, however you saw it, Tom Davis essentially went man-to-man on Lo Celso, which was really interesting. I've not seen a midfielder go man-to-man like that for a while. I think the last person I saw do that was Ander Herrera for Man U, under Mourinho probably. I forget who it was against. But
Chelsea. It was up against Hazard. He just followed Hazard around the pitch.
Well remembered, yeah. And Davis wasn't anything like that, but he was like, when Lo Celso was in his zone, he was sticking really, really close by him. And the time he kind of came out of his zone was the goal. But I thought perhaps one reason for us switching from 4-3-3 to 4-2-3-1 was to try and get Lo Celso into that pocket behind Davis and Gomez and in front of their defence to try and kind of influence things from there better. I could be completely wrong on that. That's just the way I saw it. I found the 4-3-3 okay, actually. I wasn't expecting a great deal, having seen the team selection. But Everton's midfield three of Davis, Gomez and Sigurdsson is so lacking in any kind of hard running, really. There's no athleticism or real physical presence there. And they were very passive, which helped us a lot. But I actually thought we played quite functionally well. I thought Winks's passing was good. You know, he's constantly creating angles for forward passes, even if he's not playing the forward passes himself. I thought Sissoko was kind of fine. A big improvement from his performance against Sheffield United. He wanted to do Sissoko-y things, so that was better. And Lo Celso is always neat and tidy. I felt like Lo Celso got a bit distracted by his aggression in this game. He was on proper spiteful form. He's definitely got like quite a dark streak in him, Lo Celso, and you know he's giving lip to opposition players and he's leaving a foot in here and there, and I felt he got ruffled a little bit and that kind of took his eye off the game that was happening around him to some degree, but he was fine. And so the move to 4-2-3-1 I didn't really get, and I don't think it made a huge difference. The thing that I think had a big impact on our team and the way we played was the selection once again of Lucas Moura. Nathan, why do you think Mourinho is so loyal to Lucas right now?
I don't know, man. Because he has that capacity to like summon a chance out of nothing and turn on a dime in the box, because he covers a lot of ground. I think he probably defends with quite a lot of effort, even if he doesn't defend incredibly smartly. And I think, like as I've said before, he's appealing to all coaches because of his rawness. He's obviously got a huge amount of talent and ability, but he makes poor decisions. So every coach fancies himself as the man to finally unlock Lucas Moura.
Hmm.
And, you know, manager after manager has not, you know, educated him in being aware of the players around him. So, I don't know. It's very frustrating. Like, for the first couple of games back from lockdown, I could give it more of a pass because we knew less about, like, the relative fitness of all these players. But I can't see a reason that Lucas needs to be playing, you know, nearly the full 90 every game, you know, 3 days apart. And Bergwijn, who is just, for me, in every way, a superior footballer, can't. So it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. He has a particularly frustrating style about him. He's not a bad player, obviously. I think it's easy for me to, like, allow my frustration about him to paint him as if he's poor, but he's not. He's very skilled. He's a high level player, but the means by which he puts his abilities to use is extremely frustrating. And I think he does make more sense in this sort of setup that we're using at the moment, where we're countering into space a lot. That he should be thriving more than he is in this situation.
Yeah, he's a player I think who visibly looks like he's working a lot, and the way he charges down the defenders is always going to endear himself towards the crowd and some managers as well. But I think in a quite a structured formation that has a lot of the ball, I just don't think he's very useful. And he's shown that in his output over this post lockdown period, that I don't think he's producing enough to warrant a starting place and warrant the kind of minutes he's getting on the pitch.
It's not just his output over this period, mate. It's his output since he joined Spurs. And I have to disagree with Nathan, to be honest. I don't think Lucas Moura is a high level player. I think he has a high level reputation because of the clubs he's played for. I don't think it's justified. Honestly, I really don't think it's justified. He came through as an exciting young talent because he was a really good dribbler and he's really fast. And those things are still true. He's a really good dribbler and he's really fast. But it's kind of like how Adama Traore was before he worked out that there's more to football than just charging at players. You know, if you don't put that dribbling to good use, it's pointless, and it's worse than pointless because you're a possession black hole, which is what Lucas has become. It's kind of, you give the ball to Lucas Moura to run at the defence, but if every time you run at the defence you either lose the ball or make a bad decision when you get past a defender, there's no point giving the ball to Lucas Moura. It's incredibly frustrating. He reminds me, I mean, we've used Nathan Redmond as an analogy before, but he reminds me of Nathan Redmond when Nathan Redmond was 21. And actually, I think he's probably developed into a more complete player now. But it's this kind of childishness of just head down, run with the ball. And to some degree, Son is the same type of player. He gets his head down and he wants to run at defenders. The difference between Son and Lucas is that Son is a brilliant, brilliant finisher of both feet. And he'll get his head up and he'll take a shot. And he'll create a yard and take a shot. Lucas doesn't do that. So he'll occasionally stumble through into a position where he can take a shot, and occasionally his finishing is good. But he's so unproductive generally, or has been for Spurs. I just don't think he's anywhere near good enough for where we want to be. I don't think he's good enough. I think personally that he's a lower level Premier League player or an upper Championship level footballer.
No, I think you've been a bit harsh by calling him Championship, but I could definitely see him working at a lower level Premier League team for sure. We are a mid-table team at the moment, mid to lower Premier League team. Yeah, I could see him working somewhere and being actually quite impressive, and then probably tempting a bigger club to make another bid for him.
Right, but no sort of lower Prem team is going to be able to afford him. So I don't know what happens with his career next, to be honest, unless like a Chinese club comes in for him.
Galatasaray.
Or Turkish, yeah, that's true. I don't know if that's a thing anymore, but they certainly used to waste a lot of money on abject players.
It's true with Nathan Odoi, all the things you did as well. Basically, you can't trust Nathans, they'll always let you down.
But I mean, he's such a favourite of Mourinho's anyway. He's probably stuck with Lucas for another season.
Yeah.
Yay. I mean, it's been a while since we've shit on Lucas, so that felt good. in terms of XG, it was about level this game. Obviously, we got the own goal, which is a big help. But Son had a couple of hopeful shots that were fairly close. And we had a header. I think Eric Dier had a header from a set piece, which was fairly close. There weren't a lot of good chances in this game.
But it was one of these games where, you know, we'd been taken apart by Sheffield United. And had we gone out there and just gone for it and been taken apart again, it would have been like, what are we trying to get here? I don't think we have the team to be able just to get hold of the ball and just dominate people in the attacking third. And I don't think we have the team to marmalise our opponents. So I think what Mourinho said is like, okay, we're going to at least try and be a bit defensive and see what we can get from here. I think Spurs as a dull team for the rest of the season can be reasonably effective, more effective than we can be to try and be a progressive team, because we don't have the players to do that.
Pretty much.
Bardi, so what you're saying is this was a reaction to the Sheffield United game, that he set up just to grind out a win, do whatever he can under the circumstances to get a win to follow up Sheffield United. And if that is the case, how hopeful do you feel about the style of football we might play next season?
Well, next season, there's going to be changes. Players will be moved on and players will come in, and then it has to change. But if we imagine, I'd take a 1-0 every week and then win the league. You know,
would you?
I would take it. I would take a dull Mourinho season and win the league for sure. You're telling me you wouldn't?
I don't think you can win the league with a dull Mourinho season. I think it's a moot point.
I want you to answer the hypothetical.
Yeah.
Say again, Nath.
I want you to answer the hypothetical. I want you to take it as given. If you take it as possible that you could win the league with 38 1-0s, would you take it?
I think if we were to have 38 drab 1-0s like that Everton game, I think I would probably go off football, go off Spurs.
But your team have just won the league, Chris. Not only that, but they've set a points record, a 38 win streak.
Yeah, so I would love Spurs to win the league. Almost more than anything, you know, I've supported this club for over 30 years.
And you've had to put up with some...
Yeah. It's a big deal between me and my family. People know me as a Spurs fan. So at work, people, like, one of the core values they see in me is he supports Spurs. It is embedded within my personality and my persona. If we won the league playing that brand that we saw yesterday, it would be very difficult for me to enjoy it. That's not what I see as football or enjoyment. I follow this team for various reasons, but one of them is because the sport excites me. The game of football excites me. Watching Spurs play excites me. And I would really struggle just to sort of grind out a league title. I mean, of course I would celebrate it. Of course I would. But I wouldn't enjoy it.
Imagine the first 10 games. We called the famous double winning team of winning our first 10 games of the season 1-0. You're going to be having a party. Of course it's not interesting. But Tottenham, we've tried a lot of things, but we've never tried to be boring. Maybe that's where we're missing out on things. maybe we just need to get the fundamentals right. Let's defend a bit better, stop throwing the ball in our net and see where we can go from there. And once you have a bit of confidence, if we won 12 1-0 games, mm-hmm. by the time you get to the 13th, the team is going to have a little bit more confidence and then perhaps you'd see some flowering. But I would take a league title anyway. I'll take a league title with the six teams above us all getting done for gambling.
Yeah.
I would take that title. I'd take anything windy, man. I'm tired of not
begging
winning
for scraps.
Anything.
I'd take that one more. That's a banter title. That's good fun.
And you're telling me 38 1-0s is not banter?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I'm struggling. This feels like a good time to talk about the Mourinho fans that found me on Twitter. We'll come on to this briefly in a minute, but Mourinho made some comments pre-Everton, post-Sheffield United, about the lack of desire. And I tweeted a bit about this. And what I found was a bunch of Mourinho fans who, I hasten to add, aren't Spurs fans, but some of them do have Spurs now in their bio, and they'll have things like temporary supporting Tottenham.
Yep.
They tracked me down on Twitter. Someone obviously like retweeted me, and a bunch of them found me. And oh my God, they are so weird. I had no idea these people existed. I mean, I had heard about Mourinho fanboys before, but I just assumed it was like the people that supported the club that he was at.
I have a theory on this, and it's something that I think Tottenham Hotspur, we've never gone out and signed a Galactico manager. So there's a few managers out there who are almost bigger than the teams that they represent. Guardiola, Mourinho. I'm struggling to find a third one now. But anyway, Bielsa, these kind of guys who will always be bigger than the team they manage. And we've gone and taken a manager that's done kind of groundbreaking things at Porto, at Chelsea, Inter, did some good things at Real, and then back again at Chelsea. So you've got fans from around the world who've never seen this guy before, and he turns out at a club and all of a sudden starts winning stuff. And then he goes somewhere else and starts winning. And these fans who don't have any kind of family ties, perhaps, or any kind of community ties, or kind of even geographical ties to their club, just end up following him around and around and around. And I think Mourinho's kind of earned this kind of mystique and this cult status because of what he has done, and winning two European trophies at Porto, doing the treble at Inter, winning their first kind of proper, winning the Champions League for the first time since the 60s, and then going Barrington and then at Chelsea as well, who Chelsea before Mourinho were a team that won the occasional trophy, but he ended up building a beast of a team that went on to like take control of trophies. And it was his team, his first team, you could still link that all the way back to all the way forward to their Champions League success. So you can see why he has this mystique and why he has fans of his that will follow him around. And this, I think this is just part and parcel of modern football. We will see that more fans become intransient as they start supporting individuals. Heung-min's Son, for example, we have a massive fan base who will just move when he leaves us. So I don't think it's anything new. Is it weird? Yes, but that's just kind of modern football and supporting a team from far away, I think.
Son is a cultural phenomenon in his country. I think he's a bit of a standout and he's different from them. But the Mourinho one is a very particular thing. I've been in contact with these characters for a little while now because I have launched a tirade of attacks on Jose Mourinho since long before he was at Spurs. So I've had these characters and they have Jose Mourinho in like monotone avis and really cringy Twitter ads and they will hound you and fill up your mentions with cry laugh emojis and talk in slang you've never heard before and all these things. And yeah, it's this particular type of person, and you see the exact same thing for Cristiano Ronaldo, you see the exact same thing for Conor McGregor, and it's these particular type of characters who are these sort of highly, highly successful, but also arrogant men who are these sort of self-professed winners, as if winning itself is an isolated and unique and specific skill. And I think it really draws the attention of like impressionable young men and teenagers especially. I think that not that it's always the case and not to like throw a blanket sort of psychoanalysis for all of them, but I think in a lot of the cases we're talking about teenage boys who are lacking a father figure in their life, and they see these men who are winners and they attach themselves and they say, this is the man that I will choose to follow, and I will they ascribe to this very sort of self-help kind of theory thing, if I believe I will succeed. And I think that's very, very attractive. But if there are any, you know, 14-year-old boys listening to this podcast, that's not true. Like, you have to be good at things to succeed at things. And while self-belief is incredibly helpful, so is humbleness. So is listening to others. So is self-critique. So is developing over time, recognizing your own mistakes, etc., etc. So yeah, he has this very particular strange cult. But we have to recognize that essentially they are either kids or they are mentally kids, and that is why they are drawn to him.
But I think this is also just the way that football's going now. People don't have time and patience to commit to a club, so they'll quite happily just kind of follow a player they like.
I think you're both right, to be honest. I think that football is definitely going that way, Bardi, and particularly as it becomes more globalized, then people don't necessarily have a reason to support a club. They might have a reason to support a player instead, so they'll pick the player rather than the club.
Mourinho is the biggest signing our club has made in its history in modern times. Perhaps Ardiles back in after the World Cup in 78 was huge, but football was a very, very different world then. In the last 20 years, who matches Mourinho in terms of exposure? And maybe this is what Spurs wanted. They got one of the biggest managers in the world, and with it comes the rest of the rest of the cult.
I think the second he moves on, though, the cult moves on.
It's not like
with Son, where we've probably attracted a whole bunch of Korean fans.
I think
fans.
You have fans for life out of them, even if Son moves on. I think that they have, whereas, Mourinho fans are attached to Mourinho alone, I think. Like, for example, we have a lot of American fans who, you know, followed Clint Dempsey or Brad Friedel or a combination of the two, but are now, you know, they still, years later, wake up at 7 a.m. on a Saturday to go to a pub in New York and watch Spurs play, and their love for Spurs is greater than the love they ever had for the Americans who played for us. I think that's probably true of a lot of the Korean fans, whereas Mourinho fans will simply change their Twitter rants to wherever he's at next.
And to be honest, I think they might end up hating Spurs.
Yeah, no,
they because will. I don't see this ending well, personally, and I think they'll want to blame Spurs for this. I mean, you both used the word cult, and that explains the experience I had over the last few days with these people. They remind me of like anti-vaxxers.
Very.
In a sense that they just repeat the same mantras over and over. It's very strange. It's very peculiar. They're using the kind... Winners is another thing I saw them use a lot, and it was often in caps. So they would say, he is a winner. Your club doesn't deserve him. All these kind of things. And it's like... They're using mantras. They're using the same words over and over again because that's what their cult is built on. It's built on a series of words and phrases which add up to create this mystique of Mourinho as a father figure, as Nathan put it. It's incredibly bizarre. I wasn't expecting it, and I had to just block them in the end because I tried to reason with a couple of them, and then I suddenly realised what was happening, and I was like, oh, okay, this isn't a conversation. this is me headbutting the wall. There's literally no point trying to engage. They're just so weird. And then you kind of scan down their timelines, and you realise they're just going through person by person. Anyone who says anything bad about Mourinho, they're quote retweeting and laughing at them and mocking them and saying Mourinho's the best over and over again. I mean, they must spend half a day doing it. It's so odd. But that's new to me anyway. That's my new discovery.
I mean, if Mourinho wins 38 games 1-0 next year, I will join the cult and I will worship at the altar of Mourinho.
So what did you think of Mourinho's comments, specifically the ones after Sheffield United before Everton? But I mean, we can also throw in the quote from post-Everton where he says, a team of nice boys can only win at the end of the season the Fair Play Cup, which is a thing I've never won and I'm not interested in winning. You need to grow up in your mentality and your consistency, which is kind of on point with what he was saying before about the lack of desire disturbing him and destroying him a little bit inside. Buddy, do you have any views on these quotes from Mourinho?
I mean, Tottenham's mentality is something that we've spoken about at length, and it's something which can be at times weak. And I don't know where to stand with these. Is it going to be good? Only time will tell. That's always the way with these comments. Is it going to end up like Sherwood, perhaps? Is it going to have an invigorating effect and push the players on? We don't know. Most of the time, when a manager calls out a player, it doesn't have a good effect. But we have to see. If we winning football matches changes everything, and all these comments become nothing, if we go and beat Bournemouth, then beat Arsenal, all of a sudden, life is good again. And football makes you forget everything. And I'm not upset. I'm not kind of... It doesn't fill me with like kind of passion of look how much desire he's got. So I'm sitting on the fence on these. It doesn't really bother me.
Nathan, I mean, we immediately saw the response to Mourinho's comments was Hugo calling out Son for essentially giving up a piece of defensive work. And it led to quite a kind of angry exchange on the pitch, which is very unusual. I don't think we've seen that from Spurs players for many years, if ever. What did you make of that, and what do you think of Mourinho's comments?
It's weird, man. The whole thing's really weird. Hugo does have this sort of streak of like, he's one of those quiet guys. I mean, he's not actually quiet, but you know what I mean? One of those unassuming, polite, gentle, calm guys who will then like explode in a fit of rage very, very rarely when he's upset. And I think he had that with Son, like not tracking a runner or not putting a challenge in or something. It's weird. I think people are, mostly the Spurs reaction has been a positive one because they're just pleased to see, any kind of sign of intensity and passion from Spurs players, and also something interesting happening in that game. It's weird, and I find Mourinho's comments really frustrating because, firstly, the Fair Play Award is awarded to the team who get the least cards, and we've been at the opposite end of that for years and years and years. So he's painting this image. He's doing the, like, lads, it's Tottenham thing, the Spursy thing, and it's fucking bollocks, man. It's not been true for a long time. It's true if you say that it's true. If you create an illusion around it and you buy into it and you believe it, then you make us soft, and it's just a way of putting the blame on the players, and I refuse it. I think it's nonsense.
Oh, mate, yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I completely agree. So I wrote about this over the weekend, and I was really surprised when I was tweeting about it how many people were saying, yeah, but he's right, yeah, but he's right, yeah, but he's right. And I'm like, okay, there's two things here. There's whether he's right or not, and you know, I don't personally believe that Spurs showed a lack of passion against Sheffield United. I think they showed a lack of concentration, a lack of tactics, a lack of ability, and there was no response to Sheffield United's very basic tactic, which we all know about, which is the centre-back overlapping. But also, there's whether you think Mourinho saying it in public is going to have a positive impact on the squad. And that is, for me, the bigger point. Like, if he genuinely thinks that the squad is showing a lack of desire and effort, then I think it's fine for him to call them out on it behind closed doors. I think doing it in public, like you say, it's deflection away from him, and it comes across as he's throwing his players under the bus and blaming them for, you know, what Maurizio Pochettino would have said is a sort of team. It's a team. It's everyone in together. You know, they are one. The coach is part of the unit, part of the squad. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that Pochettino was perfect either. He slipped up in some of these post-match press conferences, and particularly when things started going badly for him, he would much more regularly call the players out, which he didn't do during his peak years. And that is definitely a thing. Like, I'm not whitewashing that. I find it really unhelpful. I find the kind of toxic masculinity, like, really uncomfortable listening. It feels very old-fashioned. Whether some players who have kind of traditional values will buy into it and give that extra 10% remains to be seen. But I am absolutely guaranteeing you there will be some players who will be alienated from this.
But you're right, but Pochettino did it. I mean, I just did a quick search, 2017 against Leicester away. He said the exact same thing. The players got no fight. I was disappointed in the collective, the fight and everything else. So this isn't a Mourinho thing. This is something that all managers do at some point. So I think along with the narrative of Spurs underperforming and Spurs individuals not looking interested, this is just something that is just magnified it. But I don't think it's an issue if the players respond to it, and there's no reason to say that they won't respond to it. We've had a response post Sheffield United where we've won a game and got a clean sheet. A clean sheet is something that we don't get very often, and yes, we were helped by Everton being absolutely woeful, but still, you've got to take some positives and take a positive from it, that there was a reaction, there was a clean sheet, and there was Hugo calling out Son for what was essentially a lazy bit of play. So I don't think it's a negative thing that he's doing. Is it what I want to see from my team and my manager? No, but this isn't new. 2017, Pochettino was doing exactly the same thing.
So, Nathan, before we move on from the matches, in the Everton match, we saw Ndombele on the bench again. We saw Sessegnon completely out of the squad, and we saw Dennis Sirkin on the bench, who is a much more defensive left-back, granted, but, you know, ultimately plays the same position as Sessegnon. Were you surprised by that decision?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, like, the thing with Sessegnon has been that, like, there's a lot of competition for attacking midfield places. His best possible future probably lies at left back, but we're utilising a defensive left back. Whereas in this game, for the first time under Mourinho in quite a while, at least since post lockdown, obviously, Sessegnon's last game was we played Leipzig with a back three. But more generally, we've been playing a lot of defensive left back, Ben Davies kind of thing. In this game, we played Davies in a more attacking role, especially while we played with a back three, but even after that we continued with a more even shaped defence and both fullbacks pushing on a bit, and you would think this is a game for Sessegnon to be subbed on late and get some minutes. Now, I appreciate that Sirkin is a talent in his own right. I appreciate that Mourinho is keen on him. But I really dislike the idea of one being detrimental to the other. I have to repeat myself that Sessegnon is a really, really special, talented young player. We bought, you know, a young player who was a capable Premier League fullback and an impressive Premier League winger. Very young, English, bags and bags of talent, and we haven't played him much. It's really frustrating. I hope that there is a reason. I hope that he picked up a knock, or there was some mild falling out hurt or I don't know, illness, whatever, because I can't understand how you justify not having Sessegnon on the bench for that game when you have the extended bench size and the extended substitution availability.
I don't think there's any reason, mate. I don't think there's any reason. If there was a good reason, like a knock, he would have said that. He was asked directly, you know, Sessegnon wasn't on the bench. And his point was, Serkin was, I like this kid, he worked hard, kind of thing. Which wasn't necessarily saying he worked harder than Ryan Sessegnon, but that's certainly the way it came across.
Yes.
And I thought that was a point. I thought that was a pointed remark, personally. Of course I would say that. I'm anti-Mourinho. I've got an agenda against him.
You're not a winner.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In light of Ndombele and Sessegnon being out of the team, out of the squad in Sessegnon's case, it's come to light today through reporting by Dan Kilpatrick that Barcelona have inquired about Ryan Sessegnon and about Tanguy Ndombele in what has been described as a potential player plus cash transfer. Buddy, what do you make of these links? Do you think there's any kind of realistic way that some kind of swap deal between Spurs and Barcelona could happen?
Well, Messi's unsettled, so maybe there's something happening there. But it's madness. For Barcelona, they don't. First of all, I don't think they have the money to go out and buy Ndombele outright. I guess it would be a loan or something. I don't expect anything to come of this. I reckon it's a lot of nonsense, to be honest.
Nathan, how about you? Does it surprise you that they're interested in our boys?
It doesn't surprise me that they'd be interested. You know, that's sort of the if you can find really special talents that is being not used by another club. That's your ideal sort of swoop. I don't think Barcelona have a lot to offer us. Obviously they have ridiculous talent to their club, but they're all old. Messi's old, Griezmann's old, Suarez is old, Terstegen is getting old, Rakitic is old, Busquets is old. You know, they have a really aging squad, which is why they need to get in the likes of Ndombele and Sessegnon. But they don't have a huge amount to offer us in return. Dan Kilpatrick wrote in his piece, he pointed out, did the research and found that Barcelona are willing to part with Semedo, Rakitic, Umtiti and Coutinho. Those are the players who have already sort of been put up for availability, not specifically for this case. I don't think that... I mean, Umtiti is good, but getting old. Coutinho, 28 now. Semedo, decent, 26. Rakitic is ancient, man. It's just none of that is appealing to me. For me, Barcelona's appealing players are Frenkie de Jong, who they're not going to let go of at all. Ousmane Dembele, who maybe, but this we're talking about wingers again, which, you know, don't set me up on that. And then they do have a bunch of, like, young players, Puig, Emerson, Elena, Fati, Miranda, you know. I don't think they're going to trade us a bunch of their, like, under 23 stars. And I don't know, it's weird. The whole thing... It worries me. It really worries me that we're going to be drawn into making some absurd transfer decisions under Mourinho that short term may be functional, may be rewarding, may make us safe, but long term are terrible financial decisions and terrible talent decisions. They also reported between Kilpatrick and Jack Fearbrook, I can't remember which one, that he's... The specific wording was slightly vague, but it looks like he's definitely turned down the option of selling Sessegnon, but hasn't definitely turned down, and when I say he, I mean Mourinho here, turned down the possibility of selling Ndombele. It would be really, really terrible to see either of those players leave.
The more I see what Mourinho's done with our squad and tactics post-lockdown, the more I fear that Ndombele is leaving us. Already I see a midfield that is very functional. You know, even Lo Celso is, if you take your interpretation of the Everton match into consideration, he's being pushed forward because his pressing is helpful. I don't think we're getting the best out of him. Winks is playing a very functional role in that 4-3-3. Sissoko, we know, is playing a functional midfield role. He is a functional player and he's being prioritised. I don't think that he can trust Ndombele to do the things he wants done consistently. And it really upsets me that he could move on without having ever been given a proper chance. I mean, we've had the conversation, Nathan, about who we'd prefer to lose, Mourinho or Ndombele. And I think we're both in agreement at this point that it's surely better to lose Mourinho than Ndombele for a whole multitude of reasons. But even financially, you know, if we sold Ndombele now, we're going to have lost value on him.
Like tens of millions of pounds. And then he will grow back in value to massively, he will inflate in value.
Yeah, exactly. To well over and above what we all played for in our initial outlay. Yeah. So we're losing money. If we sack Mourinho, we lose money. If we sell Ndombele, we lose money. Either way, we're losing money.
Yep.
None of those, you know, financially, neither of those things are good decisions. Football-wise, I would much rather see Tongi and Ndombele play the Spurs than I would Jose Mourinho manage Spurs next season. But I think we're stuck with Mourinho for another year at least.
Probably, yeah.
And I think that means Ndombele is a goner, and I'm gutted. And if Sessegnon does stay, I suspect we won't see a lot of him. Maybe he'll go on loan.
There's an element to, like, a degree to which you have to... Pochettino came in, he got rid of Etienne Capoue, who I think was a good player. If you look at Guardiola getting rid of Ronaldinho in his first season at Barcelona, then doing similar stuff again at Bayern Munich, look at the players that Mourinho has ditched and then won titles with, like, obviously, like, that definitely works out in the short term, and you have to respect and allow managers to,
sure,
to cut talented players. But I also think Ndombele is such a huge asset, and that we just as a club, whereas United can afford to irritate and bench Pogba for a year, whereas Chelsea can afford to lose Mata, can afford to lose De Bruyne, can afford to lose Salah, and then just replace, not like for like, but continue to bring in similar talents just the next summer and bring brilliant academy players through their enormously financially inflated academy the next season. We can't afford to just lose Ndombele. We can't, unless our scouting dramatically improves, which I guess you could say is a plausible route. But I assume that losing Ndombele, losing Sessegnon, is going to do us years of harm in return for some steadiness now.
Maybe he sees Ndombele as a way of building up a transfer kitty as such, so that he can get in some... 30-year-old old stages that he can trust, who've got the appropriate levels of desire. When you were talking about Ronaldinho there, mate, you reminded me that you and I both got linked to a lecture by Professor Damien Hughes.
Yeah.
It's called Why Commitment Culture Wins, and it uses Barcelona as a case study to explain the concept of commitment culture. It was linked to us by Talking Spurs Pod, so thank you very much, Talking Spurs Pod, for that link. I've thoroughly enjoyed the lecture. It's like a 45-minute listen. Just listen to it like a podcast. It's brilliant. And it talks about the sort of... The blueprint of Barcelona, what they determine are their core values and how they ensure that how they ensure that those values are instilled throughout the club so that everyone's doing the same things and goes on to achieve what they want to achieve. And what they did with Ronaldinho, what they found was that he had this kind of party boy lifestyle, which was having an impact on the rest of the squad. So I think it was 10 of the first team squad members got divorced from their partners in like the 2 years while this was ongoing.
Jesus.
Yeah. And they noticed that a 17-year-old Lionel Messi got picked up for drink driving, having been to a party at Ronaldinho's house, or a party that he'd arranged. So they decided to get rid of Ronaldinho because although he was a brilliant player, he wasn't kind of fulfilling the needs of the Barcelona blueprint. And in fact, he was leading their young players astray. Now, of course, if Mourinho's got like some values and identity that he wants to instill in Spurs, and Ndombele is raging against those and causing a problem with the squad in kind of, for example, if one of them is desire, say his core value is desire, and he's not seeing that from Ndombele, who trains really poorly, who warms up lethargically, who doesn't seem to give a shit about running up and down the touchline before coming on as a sub, maybe he feels, you know, he's a cancer on this core value of desire, and he needs to do something about it, make a statement, get rid of him. And part of me is like, yeah, of course, like, you know, the manager should be given free rein to do what they need to do to get the squad to achieve what they want to achieve. But it's Jose Mourinho. I don't want to achieve the things that he wants to achieve, that are like grinding out 1-0 wins like we saw against Everton in this mind-numbing way. But then I have an anti-Mourinho agenda, so what do I know?
But you also open yourself up to that. I'm not saying that I disagree with this, but would disagree with what you guys are saying. You make a lot of sense. But the moment you open yourself up to player power over a manager, then what's the point in having a manager? You hire the manager to do the job, and you're meant to, you put your faith in him. But because he's misusing a player which doesn't fit into his plans, you fire the manager. So then what happens? You get the next manager in, and then that next manager, you sign Guardiola. Then Guardiola turns up and says, Ndombele doesn't fit what I want for my place. What are you going to do? You're going to keep sacking managers until you find a manager that suits. At some point, the manager is in charge, and that's who the chairman puts his faith in. And players are the disposable assets, I guess. So it's just a question, like, what are you going to do? You're going to keep sacking managers until Ndombele is happy.
I think you're right, mate. I think you're spot on, Barty, in terms of like you have to trust the manager to a degree to get the squad into the shape they want. However, what we know is that Mourinho doesn't stick around long, so we're going to have to do that anyway. We're going to be reshaping our squad in a couple of years regardless, which is what, like, yeah, that's why I wouldn't do it the way that Barcelona have done with them, like with Pep Guardiola, for example. The other interesting thing that was mentioned in that lecture, which you really should listen to, is brilliant, is that it's seen that managers only ever add an additional 10% onto what the team can achieve, which is something I've not considered before, but I thought was interesting. And I guess it misses out on the idea that the manager is responsible for creating the team and its ethos as well. So I'm not quite sure of that calculation of a 10%, but it was interesting nonetheless. That's a lot of talk about Ndombele. It wasn't what I expected. Didn't go in the direction I expected it to go.
Well, it's about principles of managers. And Ferguson used to cut away his big stars as well if they didn't conform to how he wanted. And it's just a question of how you want your football team, how you want your football club managed. And I don't think there is an answer. In an ideal world, they find a happy medium. Ndombele starts doing the things that Mourinho wants, and Mourinho's a bit more accepting of Ndombele as a character and as a personality and as a young man. That's what you kind of want, but life doesn't always work like that.
Sure. So next up is Bournemouth. They're bottom of the form table. They've lost their last five matches. They're conceding basically 3 goals a match. Dr. Tottenham, will see you now.
Yes. Yeah. Bournemouth?
So, interestingly about Bournemouth, Nathan, last time out, they played two left-footed centre-backs in the heart of their defence. It's a conversation we had a couple of podcasts ago.
Did they play Ake on the right? Who was...
Yes, Ake on the right and Lloyd Kelly on the left.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, Ake is a very technically gifted centre-half with the ball at his feet. I mean, yeah, if you're going to do it with someone, he'd be the one. But yeah, risky. Bournemouth are interesting to me at the beginning of the season because... Eddie Howe has long been an interesting figure in management. He was really heavily talked up by Gary Neville back when I was really into hearing whatever Gary Neville had to say. I don't mean that as a diss. So I've been interested to like get a kind of an assessment on Eddie Howe as a manager for a long time, and also for the entirety of that time, Bournemouth squad has been a mess. They've just been huge holes and huge issues with where they spent money.
Yeah.
So I've let him off the hook. I've given a non-judgment season after season after season. And this season, I looked at their squad and I said, this is a balanced squad. This, they finally put together a mid-table capable squad. Let's see what Eddie Howe does with it this season. And they're a mess. They're terrible. So, Eddie Howe, not for me. The doctor will see you now.
Yeah, I think his inability to sign a goalkeeper has harmed him as well.
Big time.
In those first few seasons, the start of his kind of Premier League campaigns, he had Boric in goal, and the guy would cost him so many goals. And then I thought they'd fixed it with Begovic, but then that didn't help. And then, I don't know if you guys remember, but when we played them, and they gave a debut to that teenager, Travers, who had he had a Lev-Yashin of a game, and then and then since then he's never caught anything since. That was proper Dr. Tottenham. And I think had they managed to sign, I always thought they should have signed Michel Vorm 4 years ago, and then I think they would have. I don't think they would be in the situation they are now. But they've been unlucky with injuries, man. They lose a lot of players. Brooks looked great last season, and he's barely kicked the ball this year.
I was about to say exactly the same thing. I don't think it's appropriate to defend Eddie Howe because, like Nathan says, he's made a real mess of things this year. Mm. But you're spot on to mention Brooks, who is a fantastic young player, but got injured like just as he was really starting to get going. Lewis Cook was another one that they brought in. Looked really, really, really good. Picked up a nasty injury, came back, picked up another injury. Out for a long time, struggling to now kind of run a games together. They've had Josh King and Callum Wilson, who've kind of run hot and cold when they're really hot. They look fantastic, and then they go off the boil and don't score for like 5-10 games. So it's really difficult to coach a team that's going through that, I think.
I just want to talk about Billing as well, because he's the most bizarre footballer I've ever seen. My eyes are just drawn to him constantly because I don't know if he's any good. I don't know if he's amazing or he's awful. Because he's just got this really tall kind of rangy figure, the way he moves around the pitch. He reminds me of a guy I used to play football with who was just like, couldn't be bothered, but was just incredibly gifted. And I just can't stop watching him. And I actually, whenever Bournemouth's on, I look forward to seeing him kind of lope around the pitch.
So how do you think this one's going to go, Nath?
The doctor will see you now, obviously. I think we may well be in for another dull one. So I said in the middle of the Sheffield United game when it was still 1-0 that, you know, we are now a dull functional team. And obviously the scoreline didn't reflect that. And that seemed like a bizarre take. But I think if you take the four games we've played, since the return to football, post-lockdown football, that's very much what we've seen. Against Everton, I think that, like, yeah, we started moving the ball really slowly at first because Mourinho came up with a smart idea to deal with Everton's pressure, but there was a price to pay for that. I think, like, literally the first good attack we had, we scored from. Never was digging into the passing of both teams, just as like Tissoko made a diagonal run and we got a combination going, and then we got a shot off, and then Winks stepped up, headed the ball to win it back, and then it fell to Lo Celso and it bounced off Michael Keane, and that was it. We had one attack, we scored from it, and after that it was, let's just shut this game down entirely and see out the win. So I wouldn't be surprised to see. I mean, that's kind of the thing with this style of football, is that it's entirely, or it's hugely, hugely reliant on being able to manipulate the scoreline in your favour, right? If you're a goal up, you can make the rest of the game a non-event. If they're a goal up, you're kind of in trouble. You have to push, even though you're not used to pushing and expose yourself. And I think that's kind of what happened against Sheffield United. So it's going to be treading that line again against Bournemouth.
So we have some questions.
And it's live.
First question is from Ricky TFC of the Fighting Cock podcast.
The boy.
He says, knowing how Jose Mourinho plays and the current players available, how do you see us lining up formation and team-wise next season? Under Poch, it was mostly 4-2-3-1 and we'd press high up the pitch to win the ball back. Mourinho uses the same formation, but our wingers tuck in more and make it harder for the opposing team to break us down. We seem to be overrun in midfield at times. Can you see a world where we switch to 4-3-3 like against Everton? He signs off, long time listener, huge fan of Windy, Nathan, the other chap. So what do you think, Bards?
I thought you were gonna go to Nathan first, but I can see a world where I go to the other chap instead. I can see a world where we play 4-3-3. I think we have players to kind of suit that system. But then I did kind of like the 4-2-3-1 yesterday. I did think it looked a little bit more stable, I think, with changing of individuals here and there. But I think our midfield looking so open is, I think our press, our counter press is pretty poor, and we can be played through quite easily, which then exposes our sitting man. So I think it's hard to say where we're going to go with this team now, because there's so many holes in it, and I don't think there's a formation that suits it. Personally, I would like to see a 4-3-3 and a combination in that three of Lo Celso, a holder, and Ndombele, if I could pick a fantasy three, and then a forward three of Bergwijn, Son, and Kane. That's what I would go with.
How about you, Nath?
Yeah, I think Mourinho is still trying to make his mind up about whether he wants to go 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, and still testing and trying things out. I do think that we played with our wingers inside quite a lot under Pochettino. I don't think there's a huge amount of difference between the sort of positional setup of Pochettino's 4-2-3-1 and Mourinho's 4-2-3-1. But yeah, I don't know. He's still trying to figure things out and work things out. I guess it depends on who we may or may not buy and may or may not sell based on our shape. But it's going to be similar. Like, it's the shape isn't going to dictate our style at all. I think we're going to see a very similar approach, regardless of the phone number that we put out there.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to add, yeah, that we've all throughout Pochettino's reign, we relied on our fullbacks to give us width, and that was why our wingers did cut inside. I don't think we're going to see that from Mourinho. I don't think we're going to see much width coming from our fullbacks. His reluctance to play Sessegnon, and well, we've only got Aurier right back. So yeah, I don't know. I couldn't make a judgment now of what formation we're going to see next year. I think it's going to be dependent on what happens in the transfer market, but I don't expect any kind of revolutionary football to happen.
I think it depends as much on outgoings as incomings, and I think if he were to get an offer for one of our fringe players that was too good to turn down, then he'd probably accept it, and that might then dictate whether he plays a three-man midfield or a two-man midfield. It also depends on Ndombele, because to fit him in, you probably play 4-3-3. If he gives up on him, then he'll probably play 4-3-1. In terms of incomings, I suspect Højbjerg is kind of nailed on at this point. It seems so likely. All the rumours suggest that contact's already been made. He's been left out of their team, etc, etc. I think he'll try and upgrade Aurier, which I don't think will be difficult. I think there are plenty of players that are better than Aurier, and it'll be very easy to upgrade on him. I don't think Max Aarons is one of those players, although it seems like the link's there. I mean, I've said before that I think if you're going to sign Max Aarons, then you might as well just keep Walker Peters, who personally I believe is a better footballer, but, you know, equally physically small and able to get dominated.
He's having a good time at Southampton right now, Walker Peters. He's had a couple of strong games on the bounce. I think Southampton are getting interested in keeping him.
Which, I mean, I just assumed would be in a swap deal with Højbjerg, and it would kind of help mitigate some of the post-COVID financial issues that teams are likely to face. You know, we just trade Walker Peters for Højbjerg, and at one point it was looking like we'd give them some money. Maybe it looks like now that they'll give us some money. Who knows? And I do think we'll sign a striker. I think we'll try and sign a striker to give Kane some support and also a rest. Milik seems like the one that we're being strongly linked with. So where Milik, Aarons and Højbjerg would not surprise me as three incomings. Like, that just seems to kind of fit what I expect us to go for, and the links are already there. So that's kind of what I'm expecting.
So if we're swapping fullbacks for fullbacks that we've loaned out for other players, you reckon we're swapping Danny Rose for Alan Saint-Maximin then?
Oh, yes please. Yes, please.
He's so not your type of player though, Windy. I'm very surprised by this.
He's definitely not a Mourinho player, but he's bloody good fun. He's a lovely, lovely footballer. Really nice feet, good technique. Yeah, I like Saint-Maximin a lot. Really like him. Big, big fan.
He's fine. Like, he's okay. I don't understand. Newcastle fans, I don't know if they still are, but they were extremely excited about him. I get the Newcastle are in a brilliantly strong place, but he's okay.
He strikes me as a better Zaha.
Wow, I think that's, I don't know, man. I'm not convinced of that.
And what I mean by that is, before anyone says that I'm just comparing them because they're black with dreadlocks, actually it's like their play style is quite similar.
No,
they,
100%.
They both start wide and are very direct in terms of running towards goal. They both do a lot by themselves, so they're not getting a lot of support from the rest of their team because they're like one of two or three attacking players at any one one time.
Yeah.
And so there's no one close to them to work off. So they have to like take responsibility for beating 2 or 3 men at any one point to create. And he's very effective at doing that.
They both have those really gangly long gates that they use to keep changing the direction of the ball and which foot the ball's on as well.
Mm. I mean, he's going to be a lot of fun for Newcastle for the next few years if they can keep hold of him. Javad Motherheady, hello Javad, long time no speak. He says, would you take Danny Ings, 28 years of age, proven Premier League experience, got goals at Burnley and Southampton, perfect backup to Kane or alternate option when Kane needs a rest? English too, so meets the criteria and the quota for homegrown players. Discuss. Are you a fan of Ings, Barty?
I'm not a fan. I don't mind him. He doesn't excite me too much. I'd take him. I still think I'd like to hear what Nathan thinks of someone like Richarlison, that someone that could play that role and also play wide at the same time. I'd like to hear his thoughts on Richarlison.
Yeah, no, I think someone who can also play wide is the way to go. Richarlison is someone who really caught my eye like the second he arrived at Watford. I hadn't seen him before. I think he came from Brazil before he was at Watford. Maybe he was in Europe. I don't know. Anyway, he was interesting then. I think now he's at Everton, he's like completely out of our price range. But I think someone who's a bit like him, for example, Ollie Watkins at Brentford, who I've recently found out has an £18 million release clause, used to play wide a lot and now plays up top. For me, like, no question, that would be a good deal for us.
Yeah, Watkins is a really, really good player. I like Ings. I really like Ings. I think he's suffered injuries at just the wrong times. He's been very unfortunate in that respect. I mean, in hindsight, Liverpool-wise, they probably should have hung on to him because he's better than Origi, but they've won the league, so you can't really question their decision-making in terms of transfers. But Ings is a very, very talented player. Like, should have been in a lot more England squads and played a lot more minutes for England over the years. He's a really good finisher, but he's also a good kind of link player, and he seems like the nicest man in the world. Like, he's got his charitable foundation, which does lots of work for disabled children in Burnley. He still like does a lot of work with that, which I think is wonderful, and it just seems like a good human being. I've noticed in the Southampton matches, last couple I've watched, obviously because Walker Peters has been playing, and I'm a Walker Peters fanboy in the same way that those guys love Mourinho. He properly like puts an arm around Walker Peters. He seems like a mentor almost to him, which is really sweet. Okay, I think we're going to leave it there. We've got other questions, but we'll save them for next time. So if your question didn't get asked, then never fear, we'll come back to it. But as ever, Barty and Nathan, it's been a pleasure. You know, we got a bit ranty at times, didn't we? But a bit more upbeat than the last one because we got a win, as Barty said.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Barty for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at @DavyShambles and his SoundCloud D. Lindner. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really